welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, bringing you shows from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Levanier. Coming up in this hour, crime. Later on, we hear Jack Webb and Dragnet. Right now, it's Don McLaughlin as David Harding, counterspy. This episode called The Case of the Statue of Death, heard on CBS Radio on August 16th, 1949.
Counterspy!
Washington calling David Harding, counterspy. Washington calling David Harding, counterspy.
Harding, counterspy, calling Washington.
United States counterspies, especially appointed to investigate and combat the enemies of our country, both at home and abroad.
Tonight, the case of the Statue of Death. Another counter-spy report to the American people. Over the hills of Tennessee, the late afternoon sun was low on the horizon. A young chemist stood on the grounds of the world's largest atomic plant, its grounds protected by high fences, its gates guarded by the latest scientific devices. As the young man walked along the grounds inside the main gate, he bent over and picked up a little gray cat.
Hello, Kitty. How's Mildred? Mouse catching business pretty good, eh, Mildred?
Hey, Pop!
Huh?
Look out for that dog outside the gate.
Oh, Mildred, here he comes. Easy, Mildred. Now, don't jump down. That collie will take your head off. I lost you. Now you're in for a fight. Here, boy. Leave that cat alone. Come here. Come here, boy. Come here. Now, let's see your cop. Let's see your cop. What's your name, huh? Ah, Tommy, huh? A beautiful collie you are, Tommy. Yes, sir. Fine head, good long, thick coat. Your master's whistling for you, Tommy. That man outside the gate, he's going to scold you for running in here. Go to him, Tommy. Go to him, boy.
Tommy, some more emery paper.
Yeah. Mr. Morton, you're working on that little statue of St. Cecilia like you was Michelo and Angelo.
I certainly didn't hire you because you had brains, Tubby. It's Michelangelo.
Here's your emery paper.
How does the statue look?
It's okay if you like antiques.
You'd never guess there's a vial of uranium compound worth $500,000. Hidden in the neck, would you?
$500,000? I'd like to kiss it.
Kissing it's all right. But keep this stuff close to you long enough, and you'll become radioactive and die. Don't you ever touch this statuette without a pair of these special gloves.
I won't even kiss it. But, Mr. Morton, them foreign guys you're in touch with, will they pay off in their own dough or good old United States greenbacks?
Stubby, you and I have lived in this dinky town 50 miles from the atomic plant for 2 years, planning and working. Finally, success. We're going to be paid plenty in United States greenbacks.
That was a slick stunt, all right, getting this uranium compound out of the gate and stuck in the dog's long hair with adhesive tape.
Yeah. The dog was so low and ran so fast, even the Geiger counter at the gate didn't register it.
Boy, I done good when I hooked up with you, Mr. Morton. You got more brains than all them bank heisters and counterfeiters I ever worked with. But now we got this stuff, Mr. Morton, how do we get the statue out of the country?
You'll never guess, Stubby. Or will anybody else?
Yeah, have to be some way like nobody ever thought of, huh?
Remember every Sunday the past 2 months, I drove over to that mountain resort 100 miles west?
So?
At the big hotel, there's a certain guest I've been studying. A wealthy Mexican gentleman named Juan Sotillo. About 47, good character, and very religious.
Yeah?
He's visiting over at the resort, but his home is in Acapulco, Mexico. And an ideal place for us to catch a ship for Europe.
Say, maybe we could stay a while then.
Stay a while. Our theft of the uranium compound will be discovered any minute. We've got to get it to Acapulco fast. And that's where the Mexican gentleman, Senor Sotillo, is going to help us.
I don't get you.
Well, we're going over to visit him, Stubby. Get the car. I'll tell you more on the way. Only about 10 miles more to the hotel where Senor Sotillo's staying, Stubby.
And what do we do then, Mr. Morton?
Every evening, about dusk, he walks along the shore of a little lake in back of the hotel. There are rowboats on the lake. I'm going to be rowing in one of them.
Oh, look, I hate rowing.
You won't be with me, Stubby. I want something to happen so this statue of St. Cecilia will mean a great deal to him, so that he won't part with it under any conditions.
Look, Mr. Morton, you hired me to help you. I've been with you 2 years, most of the time with my mouth hanging open to what you do. Why don't you explain to me about the boat and stuff?
You'll see this evening, Stubby. No matter what happens, don't come to me in the boat. That's what I want Senor Sotillo to do. There's Sotillo, walking on the lake shore, right on schedule. Now's the time.
Senor?
Mr. Sotillo, I'm the man you saved from drowning last evening.
Oh, yes. Senor Morton, come in, please.
Thank you. Senor Sotillo, I brought you a gift of appreciation. Let me show it to you.
Senor, it is beautiful.
A statue of St. Cecilia. It belonged to my mother before she died. Please take it.
No, Senor Morton. I could not accept such a beautiful gift.
But you saved my life. I want you to have it. I insist.
Well, I will cherish it, Senor. I realize how dear it must be to you.
Senor Sotillo, are you staying in the States?
No, I am starting for my home in Acapulco, Mexico, tomorrow. I am driving down.
I'll be happy to know, sir, that my statue of St. Cecilia will be going with you.
Thank you, Mr. Morton. And by you state con Dios. In English, one would say, may God be with you. Elena!
Juan! Sotillo! Oh, Juan, I've been waiting here at the mission all afternoon.
It is a long drive here from Tennessee, Elena. And I have 500 miles more to drive to my home.
Juan, I hoped perhaps this time you would stay.
Elena, I promised you that while I was in the States, I would think about us and come to a decision.
I love you very much, Juan.
I love you very much, too, Elena. But listen, and try to understand.
You know I'll do whatever you say.
Your father is a fine man, a proud man. And you are all he has left. I, too, in my way, am a proud man. And I know he does not want you to marry me.
But we will tell him my life does not belong to him anymore. It belongs to you.
Elena, I am much older than you. Your father wants you to be the wife of a younger man. And because I am older than you, I know something you do not. If you defy your father, he will die of bitterness and shame. And you could never forgive yourself or me.
Juan, you are a fine man. There is no other man like you.
Elena, I have something in the car here. Something I want you to have.
A statue of St. Cecilia.
Given to me by a man whose life I saved. It was very dear to him. What better could I do than give it to the one I love as our parting present?
Juan, I will keep it at the head of my bed always. I will never part with it. I shall pray every morning and night that she will watch over you and protect you.
Goodbye, Elena.
Goodbye, Juan. Goodbye, Juan. I love you forever.
Mr. Sotillo.
Huh? What are you doing here in my patio?
Don't you recognize me, Mr. Sotillo?
Senor Morton. The man whose life I saved in Tennessee.
And this is Stubby. A man who works for me.
Hi. How do you do?
Mr. Sotillo. That statuette of St. Cecilia I gave you in the States. I need it back.
I do not have it.
Where is it?
I'm sorry, but I cannot tell you.
Why can't you tell us?
I cannot say that either.
Maybe this gun will make you think a little differently. Mr. Sotillo, if you don't want to be shot right this minute, walk out front to our car. Sotillo! Can you hear me? Again, I ask you. Where's that statuette?
I will not tell you.
Okay, Stubby. Some more.
Yeah. You know, Morton, this guy can't take it, no.
Hold it, Stubby. Senor Sotillo, listen to me. The reason you won't say where that statue of St. Cecilia is it because you might hurt somebody if you did?
Yes.
Now we're getting somewhere. Who is that person?
I would never tell. Not if you beat me for 100 years.
Does that person have the statuette?
Yes.
Listen, Sotillo. I gave you that statuette so you'd bring it down here to Acapulco. I knew, with your reputation, no one would suspect you. But hidden in that statue is $500,000 worth of a certain uranium compound.
What?
The statue is not lead. If anyone has it who doesn't know how to handle it, that person will become radioactive and die.
Senor, you try to frighten me with lies.
You have read of the effects of the atom bomb, the radioactivity which has caused death.
I will go and get the statuette.
Tell me where it is and we'll get it.
No. And you must promise not to follow me.
All right, I promise.
On your word of honor?
Yes, on my word of honor.
I must drive 500 miles. I will start now.
500 miles?
Help me to my feet. I will be back in 3 days. On my honor.
You better hurry.
Yes. I must hurry. I must.
The dim main room of a luxurious Mexican hacienda, two men tensely face each other.
Senor Sotillo, I must ask you to leave my house at once.
Senor Fuentes, I beg of you to let me see your daughter.
I will not.
You are right to be angry. But believe me, I would not come without a good reason.
You are a man of honor, senor. You told Elena you would never see her again. I am her father. I forbid you to see her now.
Senor, with all respect, I must see Elena. And I shall before I leave this house. Her life depends on it.
Her life, do you say? You must have great reason indeed to come here now. To use such words to... I am sorry. You could not have known.
Known?
I must remember. Even now that you loved her deeply. That is the door to her room.
Her room? Is she ill?
The The doctors do not understand it. But they say there is no hope for her.
No hope?
She's dying, Senor Sotillo. That is her room. You may go in.
Yes, Elena. I am real.
Let me touch you.
I am sorry, Elena. So bitterly, terribly sorry.
Juan, on the table here, your statue of Saint Cecilia. It has been near me all the time.
I don't know what to say.
I am so happy you have come.
Elena, I'm going to take the statuette away.
Oh, no.
I must.
Very well, if you must, but for a moment, hold it where I can see it. And you. Oh, I'll be waiting for you, Juan. Sometime. Somewhere.
I promise. On my word of honor. I must leave now.
Goodbye, Juan. But I'll be waiting.
Sotillo,
huh?
Sotillo, wait.
What? Oh, Senor Martin.
You have the statuette? Give it to me.
You promised you would not follow me.
With $500,000 at stake, Stubby, let him have it so he can't talk.
Yes, this is Helen Ferguson, Mr. Harding's secretary. No, Mr. Harding's not here. He flew out this morning. He's already at the atomic plant in Tennessee.
Naturally, Mr. Harding, the theft of uranium compound from this atomic plant is a matter for the counter-spies.
Well, Dr. Corning, what section of the plant do you believe it was stolen from?
Right from this laboratory section, Mr. Harding.
It's highly radioactive, isn't it?
Unless precautions are taken, it can be fatal. Pardon me, Mr. Harding.
Sure.
Yes? What? Yes. Yes, of course. Oh, that's awful. Awful. Yes, I'll tell Mr. Harding at once.
What is it, Doctor?
One of our young chemists, Elwood Parks, has just shot himself over at his house.
Oh?
And he left a suicide note addressed to you.
Let's get over there as fast as we can, Doctor. I want to read that note. I am killing myself because I committed treason. Blackmailed by a man whose identity I never learned, but I followed his orders. I stole the uranium from the laboratory. Out in the yard, I picked up the yard cat. The man was on the outside of the gate with a collie shepherd dog. He let the dog run in through the gate, and there was a fight.
Of all the fiendishly clever schemes.
I petted the dog, but as I did so, I hid the vial under the collie's stomach with adhesive tape. The dog's owner whistled, and the dog ran out of the gate. It looked so natural, the guards paid no attention.
What a trick to have.
Now I cannot live on as a traitor. My wife, my children, forgive me.
What an end for a young fellow. If he could have given us just one clue to the identity of the man.
Maybe he did, Peters, without realizing it. In this part of the country, people prefer hounds. Not many have collie shepherd dogs. I want you to locate every collie shepherd dog within 100 miles of this plant. Peters, you can drop the siren. Now, go ahead and tell me.
Well, we've located 119 collie shepherd dogs within 100 miles of the atomic plant.
The owners all stood inspection?
The only odd situation is this family we're going to visit. 6 weeks ago, a man named Morton said he was going to Mexico and gave them his dog.
Well, that's worth investigating. I'm glad you brought along the Geiger counter, too.
With so much uranium compound taped to the body of the dog, even though it was only on him for a few minutes, it may have made him radioactive.
Yeah, there are some trucks ahead, Peter. Sound your siren. Time counts. Move the dog over this way, Father Peter.
Over with you, boy. Come on.
Now, let's try the Geiger counter. Oh, that's normal. Swing the dog over a little farther.
Come on, boy. There you go. Good boy. He sure is radioactive.
This is the dog without any question, Peter. Look at that needle. This dog will never live. Sorry, old boy.
Look at his eyes. I think he knows it, too.
Peters, you say the woman who has this dog now says that the man who gave it to her mentioned flying to Mexico.
Yes. I'll check any plane reservations made recently from around here to Mexico.
And contact the Mexican police. The thieves are going to want to get that uranium to some foreign country just as soon as they can.
I'm sure glad to see that boat.
Yes, Tubby. I'll be glad to get out of Acapulco, too. Not too happy about our disguises, though.
Why, it's the best we could do. You got the tickets.
Nice one, Tubby. For Europe.
Yeah, and a $500,000 payoff, eh? Hey.
Yeah?
We ain't going to Europe in that little tub.
That's only the lighter to take passengers out to the ship. Oh. She's anchored way out.
Don't let that suitcase get out of your hands, sir.
Never.
Huh?
Get in line. We have to show our tickets.
Yeah. You know, I got to laugh.
What's funny?
Right in our hands. Enough uranium compound.
Shut up. To... Don't you yell it out, you have.
Here's the guy taking tickets.
Tickets, please. Please show your tickets.
There you are.
You two gentlemen?
Yeah, us two gentlemen.
Want a porter for that bag, sir?
I'll carry it.
Very well.
Just a moment.
We're delaying the line. Let's keep going, sir.
Stand where you are.
Yes. What? A gun?
And another one. Right behind you, boy. Walk through that door.
What is this?
United States counter spies. Peters, I've got them covered. See if they have guns.
Right. One each, Mr. Harding.
Mr. Harding, I protest this treatment.
If I'm wrong, I'll apologize. Peters, put the suitcase on the table.
Right.
Bring the Geiger counter closer.
Yeah.
Now, let's see. Papers. Some books. Shirts, ties. Toilet articles. Morton, what's this wrapped in flannel?
Just a statuette.
Hear that? The Geiger counter tells us that whatever's in this flannel is radioactive. Open up, Peters. Let's see.
But I...
Well, statuette of St. Cecilia. Morton, is this where you hid the uranium compound you stole from the atomic plant?
I don't know what you're talking about.
You blackmailed a man in you helping you get it out with your own collie dog.
You're out of your mind. I never owned a dog in my life.
Just a moment. I have another way to make a test. Come on out, Tommy. Come on, boy.
He's jumping all over it.
That doesn't mean anything.
The dog hasn't forgotten you, has he?
Of
all the people here, he picked you right out. You killed him. Now he's putting the finger on you.
Tune in every Tuesday and Thursday, same time, same station to Counter Spy. Listen on Thursday for the exciting counter-spy case, of the desert explosion.
The man-eating birds of prey that were used to execute a betrayer, the worldwide smuggler who used geometry in action to test salesmen of information, and the 3 pennies worth of sulfur that were used to trick the killer the law couldn't touch. Be sure to be listening on Thursday, day after tomorrow, to
Case of the Desert Explosion on Counter Spy.
Counter Spy on Tuned 2 yesterday from August 16, 1949, a CBS broadcast later transmitted overseas via Armed Forces Radio. But back here in the States, when Counter Spy was on the air on ABC at 7:30 two times a week, no less than 13 million listeners tuned in. And thank you for listening to this episode of Tune 2 Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levionier. And now our final broadcast, it's Dragnet from December 7th, 1950 on NBC. This episode called The Big Picture with Barton Yarborough and star Jack Webb.
The story you're about to hear is true. Only the names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Dragnet.
You're a detective sergeant. You're assigned to Juvenile Bureau. A pair of fake talent scouts are at work in your city. Their victims, young girls seeking careers in Hollywood. The criminals are vicious and relentless. Your job, get them.
Dragnet, the documented drama of an actual crime. For the next 30 minutes, in cooperation with the Los Angeles Police Department, you will travel step by step on the side of the law through an actual case transcribed from official police files. From beginning to end, from crime to punishment, Dragnet is the story of your police force in action.
It was Tuesday, May 7th. It was mild in Los Angeles. We were working the day watch out of Juvenile Bureau. My partner's Ben Romero. The boss is Inspector Bowling, Commander, Juvenile Division. My name's Friday. It was 10:13 a.m. when I got to 1335 Georgia Street, second floor. The squad room.
Hi.
Hi, Ben.
Did you pick up that latest run the stats office made for?
No, I don't think they got it ready yet.
Notice there in the book, it's been ready since yesterday. You were over there, you could have picked it up.
Well, yeah. What's the matter with you this morning? Don't you feel good?
Just this stinking cold seems to be settling in my chest. Miserable. Yes, sir? Can I help you?
Yes. I'd like some information, please. This is the Juvenile Bureau, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right, sir. What can we do for you?
Oh, mind if I sit down climbing those stairs? Takes your breath away.
Yeah, sure. Here you are.
Thank you. My name's Wayne Kenworthy, officers. I'm out here on a convention. My home is in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Went out last night with some of the boys at the convention. We stopped at a bar down on your Alvarado Street.
Alvarado.
Anyway, we were drinking there, and the bartender got to talking to us. Finally offered us some pictures for sale. I got one of them right here. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there you are. I paid him $2 for it. Just look at that.
Yeah. Filth.
Do you have the address of the bar where you bought this?
Yes, sir, I have. But that's not the reason I'm here, though. I'm not a one-man moral squad. I'm not the type makes a habit of buying obscene photographs of young girls, either.
Yes, sir, we understand.
And I bought this picture from that bartender because I know the young girl in it. She's the daughter of one of my neighbors back home in Minnesota. Known her ever since she was a baby.
I see.
This girl came out here about 8 months ago to live with a girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
She was crazy for Hollywood, thought she might break into the movies or something. She stopped writing her folks about 2 months ago, hasn't been heard from since.
Well, it sounds like a case for a missing persons bureau, Mr. Kenway.
Well, the girl's folks have already contacted them. Nothing's been turned up. Nothing at all. Then last night, just by an accident, the bartender shows me this photograph. It's that girl, all right, no mistake.
Well, we'll do everything we can to help straighten it out, sir.
Well, that young girl I know. Known her since she was a baby. Good family, good training. She never would have posed for a photograph like this. Rotten filth. She's just not the type, that's all.
Yes, sir, we understand.
What was this young girl's name, Mr. Kenworthy?
Lois Brewster, that's her real name. When she wrote her folks she was using another name while she was out here, thought it might help her movie chances. Drake, I think that's what it was.
Linda Drake?
Yeah, that's right.
About 5'4", 115 pounds, dark hair, dark eyes.
That's right. Yeah. You know where she is?
Well, yeah, we do. We had her case called to our attention.
Where is she? Is she all right?
No, sir. She's dead. Two days before Mr. Kenworthy walked into Juvenile Bureau, the body of a young girl had been washed up on the shore just below the beach town of Venice. Apparently, she'd taken her own life. The girl was a brunette, attractive, not more than 17 years old. There was no identification on the body except for a rent receipt found in one of the pockets of a cotton jacket that the girl had been wearing. The rent receipt was made out to Linda Drake. It was signed R.L. King, 876 Peoria Avenue. The address was checked out, and R.L. King was found to be the girl's landlady. After identifying the body, she told investigating officers that Lois Brewster, alias Linda Drake, had lived at her rooming house with a girlfriend for about 6 months. The girlfriend's name was Joyce Fowler. The landlady went on to explain that the two girls had moved out about a week before without leaving a forwarding address. The Fowler girl had said that she would call back for any mail that might be delivered to the Peoria Avenue address. There had been no other leads to the dead girl's background or identity until her former neighbor from Minnesota, Mr. Wayne Kenworthy, showed up. Later that day, Ben and I met with Inspector Bowling and briefed him.
Dirty, rotten business.
I'll buy that.
How far have you gotten with it?
Check the dead girl's quints with the missing persons, Bolton. It's Lois Brewster.
We notified the girl's parents in Minnesota. They're coming out to claim the body. It's pretty tragic. She's an only daughter.
17 years old.
Same old story, we figure, Skipper. Some phony talent scout grabbed her and showed her the bright lights, got her to pose for those pictures one way or another. They can make a teenage girl go one of 100 directions after that.
This one ended up on a beach. That's all I care about now. How about the girlfriend Lois Brewster was living with? Joyce Fowler?
No word so far.
Well, what about it? Any ideas?
Well, it pretty much depends on finding this Joyce Fowler. There's no background on her. We got out on all points.
How about phony talent scouts? Cheap modeling schools, photographers? Check out that angle.
We put four of them away in the past 6 months. Another half dozen are being watched.
We can start double-checking them tomorrow.
Now, how about that picture that old fella Kenworthy brought in? Any lead there?
We gathered a dozen samples just like it. One's as bad as the other. They're all printed on the same quality photographic paper. There's no markings of any kind on them. It's a common type of paper.
All right, then get on the distribution angle. Stay on it. Every rotten bum that peddles this trash, and get them. I want them right up the line. Distributors, wholesalers, guy that prints the pictures, guy that takes them, every lousy one of them.
I still can't figure.
What's that?
Well, the Brewster girl is a good home there, good training. She knew right from wrong. Kids don't forget that in a hurry.
That might have been her trouble.
How do you mean?
She remembered it.
Wednesday, May 8th. Six teams of men from Juvenile Division, working in conjunction with the Detective Bureau, started the drive against the obscene literature and photography traffic. Within 2 weeks, more than a dozen wholesalers, distributors, and small-time peddlers had been apprehended and were awaiting prosecution. But we still had failed to uncover any new leads in the Lois Brewster case. The roommate, Joyce Fowler, the all-important witness in the case, was still missing. No trace of her. The dead girl's parents arrived in the city, claimed the body, and took it back to Minnesota for burial. The drive continued. Another week passed. On May 29th, on a tip from a usually reliable informant, Ben and I checked out a small photographic studio on Sunset Boulevard, operated by an Emil Joseph Martin. He was sullen and uncooperative. We checked through his files.
Just what I told you. A few special shots I keep filed away just for that.
Uh-huh.
Once in a while, a friend drops in. I print one of them up for him. Yeah. Hold that one up to the light. Some of them are nice-looking dolls, huh? I print one up for my friends once in a while.
What kind of friends do you have?
What?
How about this negative here, Martin? Do you mind printing this one up for us now?
Sure, officer. My compliments. How many copies you want?
One's enough.
If you say so. Let's see. One of the best. I'll print it up right now. This way. This one's a real collector's item, you know.
You're right.
A friend of mine got me the negative. $100 it cost me. Worth it, though. I'll make up a couple of prints for you, huh?
One's good.
Okay, anything you say. You want to get that light switch?
Oh, yeah, I'll get.
All right. Yeah, beautiful, nigga. Yeah, you picked a good one, all right. Yeah, there's the paper in here. Okay, one print. That's all you want?
That's all.
Okay, let's put it in the soup. Yeah, I bet you get a kick out of this one. Real beautiful girl.
How'd you happen to get a hold of this negative? You take the picture?
No, a friend of mine got it for me. It cost me a C note. There you go. Put it in the stubber. There we go. How about that?
How about the guy you got this negative from? Did he take the picture?
No, he bought it from somebody else. Don't know who. Cost him $350. Worth it, though, huh? Ah, yeah. Isn't that beautiful?
We've seen her before.
Oh, that's so, you know her?
Only from her pictures.
Oh. Of course, you understand I didn't take the picture. I just bought a negative, that's all. You couldn't tag me for that, could you?
We're going to try, mister. Get your coat.
Oh, no. Wait a minute now, officers. I'm small fry in this operation, you know that. You want the big fish, right?
We want all of you. You know who they are?
Well, some, maybe. Must be worth something to you.
Well, you know better than that, Martin. If you cooperate, we'll mention it in our report. That's all we can do. No promises.
Not a very good offer.
You're not in a very good position.
Yeah.
How about it?
All right, I'll tell you.
Emil J. Martin was booked at city jail for violation of 311 PC. His file of lewd photographs and negatives were impounded and booked as evidence. With the help of information which the suspect had given us, we were able to round up three wholesalers and another distributor of obscene books and photographs. Each one of them was questioned thoroughly. We ran into the same old routine. They denied knowing anything about the man who was masterminding a racket or where he was operating from. The Lois Brewster case dragged on. No progress. In virtually every case of tracing the lewd pictures to the point of production, the investigating officers were able to link the small-time peddlers to their distributor and the distributor to the wholesaler. Well, that's where it stopped, a dead end. Beyond that, nobody knew anything about the operation of the racket. Stakeouts were set up at locations where sales and deliveries of obscene material were known to have been made. Nothing happened. The drive stalled. Thursday, June 11th.
And now, Joe?
Yes, Gabriel?
First piece of news, number one. The policewoman just called it in.
Yeah?
Lois Bruce's girlfriend, Joyce Fowler.
Yeah?
She's been found.
You are listening to Dragnet, for the solution to an actual case from official police files.
Like most organized crime, the traffic in obscene literature and photographs is a racket jealously guarded because of its heavy profit. It's nationwide, and every year it nets millions of dollars for underworld promoters and their employees. As an organized business, it's one of the most vicious and insidious rackets that exist today, despite the fact that many citizens regard it lightly. Thursday, June 11th, 10 a.m., Ben and I met with policewoman Paula Johnson. She told us that the previous evening, Joyce Fowler, the girl Lois Brewster had been living with, had gotten into a brawl with an unidentified man at a bar on Sunset Boulevard. Police officers arriving at the scene identified her as the missing girl and handed her over to juvenile authorities. At 10:30 a.m., Joyce Fowler was brought to the interrogation room. She was a tall brunette, fairly attractive. She looked older than her age. Together with policewoman Paula Johnson, Ben and I questioned her.
I was out on a date with this man. We were sitting at the bar and he started saying things I didn't like. What a row, that's all.
The man seemed quite a bit older than you, Joyce. Was he a good friend of yours?
A friend. He was about 50, I guess. I thought he was all right. He wasn't.
How old are you, Joyce?
21.
We've checked your background, Joyce. You might as well tell the truth.
All right, I'm 17. I'll be 18 next week. Look, can't I go get an aspirin? I've got a terrible headache.
I got some in my locker.
Be right back.
Okay.
I still don't know why I'm here. What do you want to know?
Well, you were a good friend of Lois Brewster's. You lived with her, is that right?
Is that why I'm here?
It's one of the reasons. Lois spent 8 months out here before her death. As far as these officers know, you lived with her during those 8 months. We want to find out what happened to her. We want to find out what's happening to you.
Nothing's happening to me. I can take care of myself.
That's what Lois Brewster thought, Joyce. How about her? Can you tell us?
She didn't know what she was doing. I don't know what happened to her. I'm to blame for bringing her out here, but it's not my fault what happened to her. It's not my fault.
Well, whose fault is it?
All of them. The whole rotten, dirty bunch of them.
Here's your aspirin.
Are two of them being out?
Thanks.
I'll get some more.
Something wrong, Joyce? Don't you feel well?
I'll be all right.
All right, here you are.
Thanks. I don't remember too well how it started. Lois came out to Hollywood to live with me for 6 months, you know.
Yeah, we know.
We tried to get modeling jobs, bit parts in the movies. We didn't have much luck. We had to eat, pay the rent. So we took jobs as waitresses at a drive-in place out on Santa Monica Boulevard.
Are you still working there?
No, we were only there 2 weeks, and we got this other job. That's when it started.
What was that?
One day, these two men drove in with a brand new Cadillac, ordered a couple of Cokes. I could tell they were watching us, Lois and me. When they were leaving, they gave me a card. They said they were talent scouts. They asked us to come to their offices for interviews.
You still have the card they gave you?
No, I looked for it once. Guess I lost it.
Mm-hmm. Would you go on, please?
The older fellow's name was Fred Ramos. Other one was Mr. Gilbert. They were both very nice. We didn't think anything was wrong.
Didn't you go for the interview?
Yes, Lois and I both went. They talked to us a lot, had us read out of a script, walk up and down. They said both of us showed a lot of promise. They said they wanted to be our agents, so we signed a paper. Fred Ramos told us he'd see we got a break.
Mm-hmm. Did either of them ever arrange any legitimate interviews for you? I mean, with the movie studios, radio, television, anything like that?
No. They took us out quite a bit, restaurants, nightclubs. Told us we had to be seen around town first. Had to show us off to the producers, all the important movie people. Both of them were very nice.
And did you keep on working at the drive-in?
No, they had me and Lois quit the job. They said it wouldn't look right. We still had to eat. We still had to pay our rent. That's when they brought up the idea of the pictures.
What pictures do you mean, Joyce?
I'm sorry, could I have some more water, please?
Oh, yeah?
Fred Ramos and Mr. Gilbert took us out to a big nightclub one night. Fred told us that if Lois and I had some good pictures taken of ourselves, he could show them around and get us jobs as models. That is, till we got a break in the movies.
Here you are.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Up to that time, how long had you known these two men?
About a month and a half. I didn't see anything wrong in it, so Lois and I went to this photographer's studio with Mr. Ramos, and we had our portraits taken, regular pictures.
Well, excuse me, Joyce, did both of these men know how old your girls were?
We told them the truth. We were both 17.
Mm-hmm. What happened after that?
Mr. Ramos came back and said he'd found an advertising agency that wanted to buy pictures of Lois and me. He said we'd get $20 apiece every time we posed.
For portraits?
No, for posing in bathing suits, pajamas, things like that. They were supposed to be for magazine ads. In about a week, he brought us to his office and said the agency wanted us to pose without clothes, without anything. He said he'd pay us $40 for that.
Oh, go on, George.
They showed us lots of pictures of models like that. They talked about it all the time. We kept saying no, both of us, Lois and I.
Did you ever agree to pose for the kind of pictures they wanted?
You can't agree to something you don't know about. I don't know how it happened, but it did. Mr. Gilbert and Fred Ramos, they kept taking us out. We used to drink quite a bit with him. Went on for weeks, I guess. One night there was a big party. We drank. Lois and I got separated. I still don't know what happened.
Let's see.
Next morning we both woke up with headaches. Fred Ramos came and showed us the pictures. I felt dirty all over. I don't know how it happened, I swear it. Lois began to cry. I hit Mr. Ramos. I slapped him.
When does Mr. Ramos tell you?
He pretended to be very nice about it. Said he'd pay us well if we go on posing for pictures, the kind he wanted. If we didn't, he said he'd wreck any chance we might have in Hollywood. Said he'd see that the pictures got out, threatened to send copies to our families, our friends back home.
Didn't you think of going to the police?
We talked about it. We were afraid of the publicity, the newspapers. We just kept going on, doing what he said. It's like a nightmare. Kept getting worse. We kept getting in deeper.
Sergeant, you have that envelope?
Yeah.
You recognize these pictures, Joyce?
Yes.
Mr. Ramis and Mr. Gilbert, they have you posed for these?
Yes, that's some of them. We always drank a lot, so we wouldn't remember. That's not why Lois is dead, though. Those pictures aren't the reason.
Well, how do you mean, Joyce?
Ramis and Gilbert, they'd fix up dates for us. They said the men were their friends. Three or four times a week they'd call. We had to go out with them. We had to do what they said.
Hmm.
One morning we got home about 5:30 in the morning. Lois changed, said she was going for a walk. I went to bed. She left a note. I never saw her again.
Mm-hmm. I see. Romero? Oh, yeah, just a minute. That long-distance call we placed to your home, Joyce. Joanne.
Oh, thanks. Hello? Yeah, it's me, Joyce. Yeah, it was just a mistake. Yeah. How's Uncle Henry? Swell. No, it's all right. Don't you worry. Yeah, all right. I'll write you tomorrow. Yeah, bye. Thanks for placing the call, Sergeant.
You're welcome. Glad to do it.
Anything else you want to know?
Yeah, there's just one more thing. Do you still have that note that Lois Brewster wrote before she died?
No, I lost it. I remember what it said, though.
Yeah.
It said, I'm sorry. It was signed Lois. That's all.
Joyce Fowler supplied us with the addresses of Fred Ramis and his partner, Gilbert. She gave us all the names and addresses of all their friends and employees that she knew of. She also pointed out their offices and base of operations. Inspector Bowling ordered an immediate investigation into the background and business activities of both men. Previously convicted wholesalers and distributors of obscene photographs were called back in and re-questioned. We finally completed the missing link in the supply line from the peddler to the producer. Five former workers for Ramos and Gilbert fingered them as head men controlling the racket. Their offices and studios were raided and their files seized as evidence. On June 18th, Fred Ramis and his partner, Harold Gilbert, were placed under arrest.
What's the pitch, Sergeant? What's this all about?
I think you know, Mr. Ramis.
You can't tag me on those pictures.
You want to get your hat?
It's artwork, legitimate artwork. My lawyer can prove that.
He better be good.
You bet he is. You know, I'm kind of surprised that you cops taking a word to somebody like that Fowler girl. She doesn't know what she's talking about. She's a psycho.
Is that right?
Why, sure. I tried to do something with her and that girlfriend of hers. I even signed up as her agent. They were hopeless.
You've got quite a stack of negatives here. Pictures of both of them. 17-year-olds.
Ah, they're just candid shots, you know. Spicy for my private collection. There's nothing wrong in that. I figured I'd give the girls a break, let them earn a few bucks.
Yeah.
Look, I couldn't have treated those girls better. I took them around, showed them the town. Both psychos. I never did trust them.
Well, that's the big difference, Ramis.
Huh?
They trusted you.
Fred Ramis and Harold Gilbert were brought downtown to Inspector Bowling's office. Joyce Fowler was seated next to the desk. Gilbert was brought in. She identified him. He was taken out and held for booking.
All right, bring in the next one.
All right, come on.
Yeah? Can you identify this man, Miss Fowler?
Yes. He's Fred Ramis.
What's the trouble, Joyce? Weren't you satisfied with what I was paying you? Could have settled this between ourselves. If you had any beef, you could have come to me.
You're lucky, Fred. I'd kill you now if I could.
Oh, Joyce, well, come on now.
Crazy.
Sit down. All right, Sloan, take him out.
Joyce, sit down. Come on, sit down.
Be back in a minute, Joe.
All right.
I'm sorry. Doesn't do any good. Are there any more?
No, that's about all. You've helped quite a lot.
Yeah, I'm glad I could do it. Is that all, Sergeant?
Well, for now, yeah. You'll have to testify at the trial. After that, the juvenile court's going to keep in pretty close touch with you.
I see.
Aren't you going back home, Joyce, to Minnesota?
No, it'd be the same old thing. My aunt'd be glad to see me for the first week. And she'd start all over again, hollering at me, picking. Wouldn't be any use.
What are you going to do out here, Joy? You know?
I know a nice fella in Santa Monica. He's going to get me a job at a brand new drive-in. Cute uniforms.
Well, I don't think juvenile court's going to let you take a job like that, Joyce.
Well, I hope so. A lot of talent scouts go there. Radio, movie producers. They might notice me.
Yeah?
Never can tell. Might lead to something.
The story you have just heard was true. Only the names were changed to protect the innocent.
On October 4th, trial was held in Superior Court, Department 91, City and County of Los Angeles, State of California. In a moment, the results of that trial. Fred Ramos and Harold Gilbert were tried and convicted on several counts of rape and lewd conduct. They received sentences as prescribed by law and are now serving their terms in the state penitentiary. You have just heard Dragnet, a series of authentic cases from official files. Technical advice for Dragnet comes from the Office of Chief of Police W.H. Parker, Los Angeles Police Department.
This is Bob Hope. Can we steal a second? See you Tuesday.
Dragnet on Tuned 2 yesterday, their 78th program for NBC from December 7th, 1950. That wraps this hour of crime on Tuned 2 yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. It's been a pleasure.